Hey, everybody. This is Alex Lindsay, and we're back for the VFX show number 25, and I'm here with Mike Seymour. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Alex. How are you?
Very good. And what time is it there, Mike?
It's about 1:15, and the drink of choice is latte with nothing today.
It's 8:15 here in San Francisco, and the choice is soon to be a martini. And we also have a new guest, David Strapinas. And David, where are you right now?
I'm currently in Los Angeles, in Playa del Rey.
Now, what are you doing? Where are you working at the moment?
I am currently working on Avatar for James Cameron. And that's about all I'll say about that for about 2 years.
Very good. And can you give us a little bit more of your background?
Sure. I've been in the industry working now for, 10 plus years. Started working in series television, and then did my own thing, freelancing for a while, doing corporate communication work and television commercials, and didn't like running my own business. So I went off to work in video games. I worked for a company called Factor 5 on a bunch of Star Wars games for LucasArts. And then made the jump over to film, doing Polar Express and Open Season for Sony Pictures Imageworks. I worked in the mocap side for Polar Express, and I was the senior technical guy on Open Season.
Fantastic. I actually really enjoyed Open Season. So did my kids.
I got to say, that was easily the most fun I've ever had working on a project.
Now, what company was that was really doing most of that work?
Open Season was all Sony Imageworks.
And it was all Sony Imageworks.
Yeah, that was Imageworks and Sony Pictures Animation, which is really the same company. But.
Right. No, it was fantastic work. So this week, we're going to do two movies at one time because they at least according to them, did less visual effects. So we thought we'd mix them all together because of that. And so we have Live Free or Die Hard. And we also have the Bourne Bourne Identity, but it's the Bourne Supremacy, and
even the Bourne Ultimatum.
It's the Bourne Ultimatum. See, I can't even keep them straight. I watch them all like over and over and over again, and I slowly move through them. But the Bourne Ultimatum, and so these are the these two movies were unlike a lot of them when we're looking at Transformers or Pirates. These really sat much more, really depended much more on practical effects. Mike, can you give us a little bit of breakdown between these two?
Sure. I mean, I think the trend was actually set by the guys on the last Bond film. The premise being that in an action film, you need to keep it real. And certainly the publicity, if you can believe it, or the pre-film hype, was that both of these films were going to try and do exactly that. They were going to try and do more in camera, keep it more gritty, more real, and not do just a large amount of CGI, which for some reason, you know, was given the, you know, it was a dirty word. And now that is true to a point. Visual effects are often used for safety reasons and stunts, and clearly in an action film like this, there's a lot of stunts. And so there were sequences that were, you know, visual effects for stunts. There were also sequences that were visual effects just because it wasn't feasible to collapse a freeway.
There's always that. What were you going to say, David?
I was just laughing at his little humor there. I actually think that the effects in or the stunt work in Die Hard was, you know, just not plausible to me because of it just seemed very unrealistic. That's, you know,
oh, really?
What they were pulling. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you have a guy jumping out of a helicopter that's exploding 4 feet behind him, and he seems okay with it. And I think in Bourne Ultimatum, it was, you know, not everyday action, but it was at least, you know, if you're a super spy, somewhat plausible. So,
well, I mean, I think Die Hard pretty much has I think that with any of these films, I mean, to Bourne Identity maybe for a little bit less, but with any of these films, I think we're in a situation where it's, you know, you really have to suspend your reality check, you know, to make most of these work. I definitely moving that to the CG now they did that. Did they do it with miniatures, Mike, or did they actually do a lot of CG?
Which film were you in now, sir?
I'm sorry, with the Live Free or Die Hard, what you were referring to back
right.
with the...
There was miniatures, but there was also a lot of CGI, and I think The Orphanage did a really good job, don't get me wrong. Like, I think that this is the same old problem we've got. Like, I think I might have joked about this before, right? Why is it an action hero can sustain 50 multiple bomb blasts and Exocet missiles, but then winces whenever he gets kissed by the heroine? Of the film, and you know, there's the sort of the scale of, and that's been the same since the Indiana Jones films, and sometimes it just doesn't matter, right? And in the case of Indiana Jones, the fact that he's hauled along by a tank, you know, we're rooting for the hero and we don't care. But in, so that we have to separate this kind of plot level stuff from, did the effects house do a good job in pulling it off? And they're obviously sometimes completely different problems, and it's hard to separate one from the other. But let's face it, you know, it's very rare that a particularly bad film wins an Oscar for visual effects, because the two are so intertwined. And in the case of Die Hard, that end sequence when they've got the jet against, or the Air Force plane against the truck, that whole freeway section never existed, and that was a combination of miniatures and CG by The Orphanage.
And The Orphanage... Go ahead. Sorry, David.
Did that completely not exist? Because I remember when they shut down the freeway, the 105 here in LA, to film that. So was there some stuff that was shot practical and then?
Yeah, there was. For example, there was a shot where the truck is coming towards the jet and it's turning a corner. Well, behind it was a giant green screen, but that was only a corner of the freeway. There was no multiple looping overhead freeway section that you saw in the kind of the wide shots. I'm now talking about the climax of that particular chase sequence.
Right.
And it was a very peculiar kind of, almost, if it was a staircase, you'd have called it a spiral staircase of freeway, that I don't know any freeway designer in the world that would have, like, looping up into the sky freeway designs. But, you know, it worked for getting the car, you know, I get this truck at the same height as the jet, how am I going to do it? I guess we just design a freeway that does that. And interestingly, that whole sequence came in relatively late into the production schedule. So again, this is a film that was had its effects artists facing incredibly tight deadlines.
Well, and this gets into it. Just you know, I find it interesting when you deal with a movie this big to revamp it that quickly at the end. I mean, I understand going back and forth, but I think that this also comes back from directors. And to me, I have to say, I feel like directors sometimes aren't as disciplined as they could be. Related
definitely.
To, you know, this where they of course they can change it, but the real question is whether they should. David, would you agree?
I would definitely agree. I think it's actually you know, kind of a result of all the technology they have, where they can go and bring something up in the Avid or Final Cut and just noodle and recut and do whatever they need. Whereas before, when it was actually on film and you had to cut it, like literally cut it together, you were a lot more locked into what you had to do well beforehand, that you couldn't do these last minute changes and expect them to really get done in time. But you know, our whole world is sped up.
Well, and I think there are also a lot of times when we rush it, this is where we see weaknesses in effects oftentimes. So if we see a bad composite or things that don't work quite as well, a lot of times it's not a production company dealing with a normal stress. I mean, it is because something got changed very dramatically at the very end. Now, Mike, they did a lot of, they also did a lot of matte painting to kind of pull all the stuff together.
Yeah, there were matte paintings. Actually, the one I thought was the sort of indicative thing for me between the two films by way of comparison, and I know this is the stupidest thing to go for, but it just came down to, you're driving in a car, how believable is what's outside the window behind them? Do you know what I mean? And in Die Hard 4, while it was good, it just wasn't as real as the car interiors shots from Bourne. So it's the classic.
It was decidedly bad. I don't know who did that. I don't know who worked on those, but some of them are better than others. It was. I noticed it pretty dramatically. Actually,
that was the best thing I think about Bourne, is I never noticed any effects. You know, and I'm looking for these things in films usually when I'm watching, and I didn't notice any. Like, I didn't go, oh my god, that had to be a composite or anything like that. It was all seemed perfectly done, you know. And I think that Bourne.
Did Bourne Identity show up for that for you that way?
Yeah, look, I thought it was brilliant. My main criticism of Bourne Identity is the guy I went with, one of our editors here, got motion sickness in the first 5 minutes of the film.
Oh, okay, I gotta say, I pity whoever had a motion track anything in that film.
Well, maybe not. I mean, to be honest with you, I find, and this may be my own experience, but my experience with match moving is that if you move the camera a fair bit, I can make that work. The most complicated match moves are these, the end of a long jib shot that's kind of bouncing or it's just subtle and you got a lot of subpixel movement. Getting that to really lock in, I find oftentimes is more challenging. Now, not heavy motion blur. I think going back and forth is complicated, but I think that when the camera's got a fair bit of travel, you know, the parallax that it provides for the tracker, I find that a lot of the auto trackers, especially when you're not sitting in a green screen, can grab onto a lot of detail and make that work.
It's just the level of motion blur. The problem is the motion blur. Like on those long lenses with the shakes, you just don't have any detail. Mm-hmm. And because it's a long lens, you've got
not that much
cinematic, everything is out of focus behind problem. So it's out of focus
and it's defocused
by the motion blur. And I mean, I totally agree with you. It's great if you've got some movement in the shot. But, you know, even to the point of, like, let's keep the shot running so I can then swing the camera around and have a bit more view of what's going on so I can work out the geometry. But in this particular film, that first 5 minutes just was unsettlingly close, tight, and wobbly.
And the last two Bournes have been that way, right?
Yeah, and actually the first 5 minutes of this movie are taken from the last movie, where I think Greengrass really took a lot of the criticism well, and he did calm the camera down a lot more in this one. So I think that first 5 minutes, because it came from the last film, is a little bit more shaky.
But, I mean, I actually have heard of people anecdotally leaving the cinema, and certainly the guy I was with actually had to physically look away from the screen because he was getting ill. And, I mean, you know, I understand that we want to keep it gritty and real, but... You know, there were times in this film that I was like, can I just get an establishing shot so I can work out what the hell's going on, who's jumping who where?
Yeah, that was the one effect that stood out to me in Die Hard was, you know, he had these long kind of tracking shots that went with the action that kind of screamed out to me, this was done against green screen and now we're putting it together afterwards.
I have this problem also when filmmakers do the impossible shot because they go... I want to design this shot that's impossible to do. And I'm like, I don't see how that serves the story. Like, I mean, I find these just really annoying when you're in a pitch meeting and then I want to do the shot and it comes around in the car, out the window, across to the other car. There's no way this shot could be pulled off. And I'm like, so the audience has to, what, stop thinking about the movie and start thinking about how clever you were as a director? I mean, I don't get why that's such a... I mean, occasionally there's a cool shot. I'm all for that, right? But just designing shots that are, by definition, impossible strikes me as being... You know, against the plot, really.
Well, Zemeckis does that well.
Sorry?
Zemeckis uses that very well to drive the story. These long shots that are impossible, that, you know, they scream at you afterwards that they're, oh my God, this is impossible, but they, you know, in Contact, they have that long tracking shot following her all the way out from the array into the lab. That was pretty cool.
Oh, and those shots are great, right? And the opening shot of the film, The Player, by Altman, just magnificent, right? Just breathtakingly great, but for different reasons, right? It was plot-driven. It was like, this is this world that's chaotic and constantly moving, and this is what's happening, as opposed to, hey, look at me, I can force the effects team to cry in their, you know, on their digitizing tablets because this is going to be the hardest shot in history to pull off.
Well, and I think that a lot of times, that you know, I had an experience to do a little bit of Steadicam work, myself, and I have a whole new respect for Steadicam artists. I mean, I have because of what we do, I end up, you know, hanging on to, you know, ending up in lots of different hats, you know, to work on something. And you know, after working on this Steadicam project, I watched The Matrix again, and there's a scene in the fight scene, you know, the only fight scene in the Matrix. No, the one where Neo is actually saying, you know, I know Kung Fu, and Morpheus is like, show me. And there's this, they're fighting, and there's this Steadicam shot where the guy is actually, you know, he's coming from behind Neo, coming around, and you know, he does this full circle, and really, it's not that it's an impossible shot. I mean, it's done in camera, But what was amazing was him keeping all of those, you know, keeping all the framing was perfect, you know, all the way through it. And
okay. I totally agree with you, except for, I'll give you one better, the stuff in ER, in the early series of ER, when they're doing all of that on episodic television timescales.
They
actually, for ER, the episode that brings that to mind is the episode they did live, where they didn't have a second take.
Yeah, or they did it twice, once for the West Coast, once for the East Coast. How cool was that?
Yeah, amazing.
That's just showing off at that point. And I'm going to say one more, and then I'm going to move back to visual effects. And I know this is going to be a crazy one, and people are going to... This is like a rat hole, like, world here. But I know that you will never think to listen to me on this one, but if you go back and watch Alton Brown... You know, Alton Brown, I guess, it turns out he was a cinematographer before he taught us how to cook. Have you guys seen any of the Alton Brown stuff?
Of course.
And the camera work in Alton Brown is actually pretty amazing. Like, really, really, really well done. You know, and it's why he's also really good at what he does. But just watch the camera work. It's you wouldn't think of it because it's done so well. But just take a look at it. I know we're going off on a tangent there. But,
And actually, as a side tangent to the tangent, when you brought up Matrix, can we just all agree that parkour is the new wire foo that has to be in every action movie?
In every commercial.
Yeah, so. it's but I gotta say, I like the fact that in Die Hard, you know, again getting back to the green screen tracking every action, every piece of action, you could actually tell what was going on in all the parkour action, you know, and it made it look faker than it was, because I'm sure the guy really did that, but in Ultimatum, you know, they had this. The camera barely catches the action as it's happening. So, I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying about that, but it's the way that he treated the camera in Die Hard, where it showed all the action. It showed off what the stuntmen were doing, and that kind of made it look a little bit more fake. You know, the car crashing down between the two. Perfect example.
Right. Now,
beautiful shot.
Yeah,
well,
no,
if it hadn't
been
lifted from Jurassic Park 3 or 2, I would have like really liked that shot.
Well, there's that. And so now, the orphanage did the bulk of the work for Die Hard?
Yeah, there was a few houses on it. It was the orphanage that them and Digital Dimension, I think, was the two primary houses. And the sequence I was telling you about with the, you know, that truck and stuff was the orphanage's sequence. And I thought that, and as I said, I thought they did a good job in terms of stuff. Though it was interesting that there was a lot of heat haze and stuff on that jet that apparently they did just superb work on and got sort of editorially cut down. Because in reality, if you have any sort of Harrier jump jetty type thing, you know, generating that much thrust power, you know, it's basically just you can't see for what's going on. And so, of course, that sort of was taken out for drama reasons. So apparently there is a cut that's sitting on a cutting room floor somewhere which has brilliant jet exhaust, but I haven't seen it myself.
and you know, a couple technical notes on what they were doing. They have, of course, the environment. A lot of the stuff was done in Maya. They did 3D matte panes, which were projection mapped. Mike, have we really dug into projection mapping much at all? Have we talked about?
I think we discussed it a little. I think it's really interesting also as a complete outsider observing the pipeline at the orphanage, because it was at one stage an After Effects pipeline, then it looked like they were going to go to a Fusion pipeline, but on this, as you correctly pointed out, they were using Nuke because they were doing a lot of projection mapping in Nuke, and Nuke is superb for doing that. And I think it's interesting that there's almost this, and I'm not saying this is, I don't know this for a fact, but it's almost like I'm feeling that post-Shake, people are searching for what it is they're going to settle on as the new default film pipeline.
I know a lot of people are afraid of what's going to happen with Shake.
Well, I mean, it's what a lot of people are having right now is that they have, I don't know if we should, how much we should get into this, but the you know, you have people have the source code, but they didn't really, the reason they got into Shake was they didn't want a they didn't want proprietary software. They wanted off the shelf that they didn't have to put research into. They want lots of artists that are using off the shelf software that they can hire because they don't have everybody in house anymore. They have all these other, there's all these things that doesn't really open. Just giving them the source code doesn't really solve that. And I think that the other issue that you get into is that it's not clear that Apple's going to really release. I mean, maybe they'll release something new, but when you look at the advances in motion, it leaves me to believe I'm not really sure that we're going to see something that's higher rather than just bringing motion towards it, which would never really solve, fill the hole for Shake, but it also, I don't know if Apple really feels like they need that hole to be filled. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of my compositor friends are really, they were really upset when Apple bought Shake, and they haven't gotten over it yet.
I think Apple did a lot of good for Shake as well. I mean, I don't think that they bought them and ruined them or anything. I think that they weren't going to, they needed the cash inflow, and they needed all those other things to make it work. They had 200 registered, I don't know, I'm just guessing, but they had something, hundreds of registered users when Apple bought them, so it's not. I don't think Apple hurt them in that sense, but I do think that it did come to a point where you needed to rewrite it.
I think everyone's of the feeling that Nuke is the new big thing for off the shelf.
Right.
Fusion.
Now, have you guys used? Are you guys fairly experienced with either one of those, Mike? Mike,
at FXPHD, we're running Nuke training courses. And by the way, it's just the building that's burning down in the background. If you can hear a siren in my audio feed, it's apparently the building's on fire. But I'll just say, because I'm that committed to the VFX show that I'd prefer to burn to death than get out of the building safely. We're so far away from major bushfires that the chance of me actually dying. But anyway, getting back to Nuke, we run FXPHD training on Nuke. So yes, we're pretty familiar with, and I guess I should not leak the fact that we're likely to be running Fusion training next term. But I'm not really up in Fusion as much, though I've met the guys, I know them, they actually started in Sydney. And and had some really nice aspects to it. I mean, particularly like some of the stuff to do with their tracking. I guess the thing is that into that mix is also Toxic, which has been the big theoretical play for Autodesk, but yet to sort of take off.
Well, what's the price point on Toxic?
Toxic's just changed in price. It used to be you could only buy 5 licenses at a time, and not only that, but the 5 licenses necessitated that you had a database as a collaborative workflow. They've removed the database, so you now can have standalones, and that's, I don't have the list price on me now, but that's also brought the price down, because part of the price of Toxic was that third-party Oracle database that was allowing for the background manipulation. I mean,
no, is Toxic less than 10 grand?
Oh, yeah.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know a lot of people were overjoyed when they got rid of the database, and they're like, now we can actually look at this thing.
I used to say that I was the database antichrist, because every time someone said to me, oh, I've got this really great orthogonal solution that involves all your problems that involve database, I'll fuck off, because it just never works. It's like this theoretical thing just doesn't actually happen, that these databases always cause a huge amount of underlying complexity, and, it's about the shot. I'm sorry, people don't buy software because it's got a great underlying database. They buy it because you can do cool effects with it.
Now, I know Digital Fusion, I think, is a CPU-based. Does it really depend much on the GPU to get its work done?
They have incredibly fast and very good memory management. So this means that, just to start back where you, or flip back to where you started, when you're doing camera mapping, the idea is you get a very large matte painting projected over relatively simple geometry, and you can pull off some amazing cool stuff to a point. That's really where you show up Nuke as being so cool, because the render engine is very clever. You give it a 13K frame to be your texture map, and it's not going to turn into molasses and slow right down.
Right.
And it's also, that was how they built Toxic as well, because increasingly those big matte paintings are either HDRs or close to HDR type files. They're big in size and they're big in bit depth.
Yeah.
Right.
And actually, I think the bit depth thing gets into why Nuke got adopted so quickly is because of its support for, you know, the ultra high bit depths and formats that support it, like EXR.
I totally agree.
In fact, I think that was the that was the real issue with Shake. I mean, as a, someone who used Shake a lot and still uses Shake, one of the issues that you got into was that it didn't, you know, there was just all this stuff that was kind of, you know, it had, the code base had gotten a little old. You know, and it, while it supported a lot of that stuff, it wasn't doing it very as efficiently as it could.
The thing about Shake and Nuke, though, is that they tend to be, and less so Nuke, I guess, but Shake in particular, tends to be very good on a shot where 3D is giving you the elements and you're putting it together. And by the way, the fire is getting closer to where I'm sitting. Just joking. The thing about compositing packages, I don't think anyone's cracked yet, is a better UI experience than Flame gives you in being able to put together the complexities of a bunch of material to sort out how the shot should go together. In other words, if you've got a shot, look, this CG element goes over this background, we need these holdout mats and these things, and it's really sort of like, they're all your elements, Shake nails it, that's all good. What we're wanting is, and I mean, Flame is the only thing that does it right now, is like, here's a bunch of materials and elements and stuff, and you need to work out how they're all going to go together to solve this very complex effects problem. But I have the bits, I just don't have them in the right order yet. I don't know what the sync is, I don't know how they will fit. And in that respect, you've got like a 5-to-1 speed improvement over using something like a Flame. Trouble is, doesn't support OpenEXR. So what I wanted them, I still want them to do with Toxic, is to reintroduce some of that hardcore, I can deal with a clip flexibility that we're not seeing in the compositing packages as much as we'd like. Now, maybe Nuke will add it, because there's a new version of that coming out. Maybe there's a, it's going to come in Toxic, I don't know. But I don't think we're there yet on the to-die-for compositing package.
Well, I think a smart compositing package would pay attention to OpenEXR and all the extra information you can stuff into that file, because you can, you know, you could give it a whole pile of files and have it almost build the composite on its own based on all the metadata that's stored in the files.
Yeah, but see, that's my point, though. If you've got the shot sorted, then, yeah, absolutely, I totally agree with you. A scripting-based solution with a tree, you know, all you tip all the ingredients at the top of the tree, it filters down through the tree and out the bottom pops out your shot, is great. But my point is, I mean, that's great on a very disciplined film pipeline. Now you've got a really complex shot, and you've got a bunch of elements, and you're trying to make it work, and it just wasn't the sort of shot that could be put together that way, right? And now you're trying, what are you to do to sell the shot? What have I got in the library that I can reuse? How can I slip things and flip them and make it work?
Well, now is that just proper timeline management? I mean, because when you're describing this, I mean, when you just describe it, you know, I go, what did I use? I mean, because I did a lot of this stuff that really felt like that when I was working on Star Wars, and I was like, oh yeah, that was After Effects. And I'm not saying After Effects is in the same world, but it was like what made it work was that I could very quickly and easily just kind of move all my timelines around and transform everything very, very effectively. Is it the timeline issue? Because I know that from my point of view of Shake, it was almost unusable.
Well, see, that's interesting you say that, because it's a timeline. That's the thing. At the moment, you've got like a nodal tree or a timeline. Now, Flame gives you something completely different, which is this flexible desktop. And I guess my point is, it works well, Flame, in commercials, partly because I'm going to piss everyone off here and say this. Commercial directors just don't have to be as disciplined sometimes as feature film directors, because it's just like a few shots and you don't really need to have entire pipeline set up. You just do the shots, right? You shoot a bunch of elements. You don't have to have it all. You know, there aren't effects editors. It's just, now some commercials there are, but for a lot there aren't. But a lot of those commercial directors are now directing features and doing increasingly the same thing, because we're going to get digital capture on features, you know, shoot a lot of extra B-roll stuff, just messing around, sorting stuff out. Those tools aren't as widely available. And like, yeah, After Effects has that to a point. Flame has it in spades.
Right.
I think it's also about, you know, what volume of data you're trying to put through it. I mean, I'm with Alex on this one, that when I need to do a quick and dirty composite, After Effects is the first thing I look to. But, you know, if you need to get massive amounts of, like a massive composite, I would never go to After Effects, because it's not built for that.
I when I have a lot of, and this gets back into the two different things, that if I have a lot of pieces and I roughly know how I'm going to put them together, I'd much rather be sitting in a nodal compositor. If I don't quite know what's going on and I'm just sorting stuff out, you know, I want more control over the timeline, and I'll be in either, you know, we use a lot of, you know, obviously we use shake a lot for the, you know, film type work. We use After Effects a lot for, you know, the, what I would consider kind of the heavy duty, heavy duty motion graphics stuff. And then we've been really picking up doing a lot more in Motion just because we have some proprietary stuff that we built into Motion because of the XML back end. And this is something that is also really, really important for a lot of these, depending on what software. But the other thing that these large software packages tend to let you do, and I'm not familiar as much with Flame and so on and so forth, is, and this gets to what Toxic was touching on, was being able to get a hold of the, you know, working with a kind of an open file format. And I think that was one of the other things that for us was just intoxicating about, you know, Shake coming from After Effects. After Effects had a binary, you know, I couldn't really open it. I couldn't do anything. We could ask them to open up some stuff. But with Shake, we just had a text format, and we just go in and change stuff, you know, without...
Not only can you change stuff, but you can actually, you know, write stuff that will automatically create a rough Shake composite for you automatically via, you know, Python as part of your rendering queue.
Well, I mean, and we do the same thing. We do the same thing we do with Shake. We do with Motion when we're doing. This is mostly for motion graphics for some of our shows. Is that, you know, a lot of that stuff is all just completely driven out of a Python script. You know, and it's not, you know, we don't do anything. You know, and we change lots of stuff over and over and over again. And that's not for film work, but it is an important part of a pipeline to make that work. And I don't, you know, to me, in a very large environment, a non-text-based file format is, you know, painful. I don't know if you're that opinionated about it, Mike, as I am.
I like the scripting stuff, and I'm obviously in a television or episodic environment where you've got, you know, shows plowing through that have a lot of graphics. There's just no other way to go, right? I guess, you know, I just was... we've just filmed at Stargate Digital for an upcoming episode of FX Guide TV, and those guys got 3 Emmy nominations for Nightmares, Grey's Anatomy, and Heroes. And I'm just struck by the huge volume of effects these guys are putting through. And, you know, in that environment where you've got to really come up with it, and they have insanely short times and trying to produce really professional stuff, you know, it's a wonder that we don't have a couple of better tools for just managing the non-organized, the non-well-thought-out shot, is what I'm trying to say, I guess. Because I think you're totally right. In the motion graphics area, that is well-solved. It just doesn't feel like it's well-solved at the desktop level for... Right. A guy who's saying, you know what, this time we got to this week have the character explode in flames, and we've got some flames over here we shot, and we did this, but we ran out of time, and you got to get this done in 2 weeks, and thanks very much.
Right. I agree. Yeah, we've gone off on a tangent that I thought was fairly useful. I don't know if we really have a lot, because these weren't heavy effects.
I just wanted to ask about the grading, because I was just struck that, and I think I'm saying this right, in the beginning of Die Hard, it was just blue. It was just... You know, there was like, and it did the grading, because obviously these films are now so in the zone of DI that we're just getting directors that just do almost completely desaturated and just a little bit of skin tone, and the rest of it's just, you know, bluey greeny. It honestly looks like a commercial to me.
Yeah, I thought that Die Hard, you know, you look at, oh God, I can't remember the guy who directed his name, but, you know, he did the Underworld films previously, and, you know, for having aesthetically very different design work, the look of the film is very similar.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. I'm just wondering, this whole thing about realism, we've discussed it in terms of visual effects, but is there an argument to be said that an old-style DOP who was lighting it in the camera, that's also sort of going by the way of the dodo, and that, you know, these are just now becoming incredibly effects-y-looking shots?
Even the real stuff looks unreal?
Well, a little, because it's just none of it's a sort of sane color palette, right?
I love it. I mean, I'm afraid that I love the rise of the DI composite, of playing with colors and using the color palette as a story element and pushing that stuff back and forth. I mean, I don't think I really woke up to it until I saw... Maybe Brother Where Art Thou or The Matrix, and really saw how far things were getting pushed to give a certain, or Traffic. And I thought that, you know, probably one of the best examples of using color for me was Traffic, where you had this incredible process that they did it with everything in Mexico, and then a whole different process for what they did in the United States, and it so clearly cut back and forth. And then when you look at the Matrix, the feel that they created with those things, and all these things are, I do agree that they're doing it, and I personally I just think it's a great story element, to kind of go down that path.
But you can do it. You can do it via DI, or you can do it. What was that movie? Three Kings. You can do it with what. It's a little harder with HD, picking what stock you use and all that kind of stuff. That may have more to do with how DI things are getting. But you can do a lot of this in camera. You look at something like Zodiac.
You could, but why? But I guess I kind of lead into why. Why would I? Yeah, go ahead.
You don't even want to balance your cameras.
I don't. I actually want to. I need to qualify that. When we do multi-camera shoots on little cheap cameras that have a very limited amount of control, I tell the guys to set it to indoor or outdoor so that all the cameras are set the same. When we shoot with bigger cameras, I do white balance them. I just don't like doing it with the little ones because they're so inaccurate. It's like trying to do surgery with a broadsword.
Just being facetious.
I have to admit that I'm so used to I love looking at film. I love looking at people. I would never actually shoot it. The idea of committing too far on set, there's just typically just so much going on set that, to me, I just want to shoot it as neutral as possible so that I have as much leeway later as possible.
Yeah, but this gets back to our discussion earlier on, where if you can keep noodling it and keep trying to get it exactly what you want, you're going to be undecided up to the last minute. And, there's something to be said for getting it in the can and relying on your DP to give you the look that you want.
I have a hard time. I have a hard time with that. Generally, we do when we work on shows. There are a lot of things that I try to do on set. We are when we do green screen. I am maniacal about my green screen because I have to deal with it later. Generally, if it's a flat green screen, if it's not a psych where you see the ground, if it's just the flat background behind someone for a talking head or whatever. If my variance on my entire green screen is more than 5%, for us that's out of spec. And that's just the green, in the green record. And we really don't like to, we really do. It is worth spending a lot of time on set getting things right. But at the same time, to me, getting it right is to get it so I can work it later, into something that we're going to use. And I think that, I just think that there's so much going on set. That's not. I'd rather be worried about the performance of the actors. I'd rather be worried about the lighting. To make it look good. But that is important. But to worry about the color grading or the color feel while I'm doing it, to me, I feel like it's a hard thing to control. You're going to go back and fix it anyway.
Right.
And I'm not saying you shouldn't go into it thinking it's going to be a certain way. I just think that I would never commit to it on set.
David, what was your opinion on the grades of the two films?
The look of Die Hard was, what's a kind word for it? Cartoonish at points, I thought. It was big, it was loud, it was shiny, and all the colors were very bright. And I thought that Ultimatum was, you look back at all three films, and even though they're two different directors across three different films, and Ultimatum was 140 days of shooting, the film going from season to season in Morocco to New York in winter all had a very real, consistent look and feel that fit the location. The Morocco stuff was a little bit washed out and sandy and bright, and the New York stuff was slightly hard. It wasn't as in your face as Traffic, but I thought it was. I don't know. I dug Ultimatum a lot more, even though I didn't like the movie as much as I liked the first one. But
Actually, I was going to say that I thought the film, I mean, I liked the film as well, but I thought the film didn't feel like a third film in a trilogy. It didn't feel tired. I mean, Die Hard was obviously the fourth one, so you're comparing a fourth to a third, but still, they're none of them, you know, fresh out of the gate, and yet I just thought Ultimatum felt fresh.
Well, Go ahead, Alex.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm almost not even qualified to talk about The Bourne anything because I watch the movie so often, you know, and I love The Bourne, the whole Bourne process. And I didn't know anything about the books. I didn't know anything about the old movies when it came out. And what I do love is that kind of very practical, the whole way the movie shot, the way he acts, the way that very practical get the job done, you know, kind of whatever is I find very appealing. So I enjoyed it a lot more, but I don't think I'm very subjective.
Don't get me wrong. I love the movie, but I made a realization about the Bourne movies is Jason Bourne is Wolverine. You know, he's a government trained killer who doesn't remember who he used to be, except for they're telling his origin story in reverse. You know, the third movie was his origin versus the first movie. It was, you know, kind of a weird thing, which is. There's a lot of exposition and stuff in the movie, but you know, we're getting to story rather than effects, but that was just my thought.
Yeah.
So this funny thing in one of the forums about, you know, it's quite a common thing, you know, would you go for James Bond over Bourne, you know, JB versus JB? And the universal sentiment was most people would go for Jason Bourne over James Bond right up until the second James Bond pulled up in the Aston Martin. And when the Aston Martin pulls up, you know, bugger it, I'm off with the martinis. Thanks.
Well, there's been comparisons between, you know, that... these movies have taken a lot from the last Casino Royale, but I think Casino Royale was more a response to the first Jason Bourne movie because, you know, it's a new type of spy.
Well, I think, yeah, and I think that, I mean, at the end of the day, it becomes incredibly subjective at this point, but I guess not to go too far away from the effects, it's got to be testament to the fact that in this discussion that we've had, which has been going for like whatever half an hour, we have not been picking at any effects in the Bourne Ultimatum as if there were none. Do you know what I mean? Like if you were sitting listening to this and you'd worked on the film, you'd be both thrilled to death and completely ticked off that we'd like not discussed your work.
And admittedly, I think part of the thing is there hasn't been as much coverage of it either. I mean, they've been pretty, you know, I guess people don't think of it that way. And that's it's really well done effects. It's also very well integrated. And I do want to say that focusing on the physical effects and taking full advantage of what you can do and what we used to do, what we used to see in Indiana Jones and, you know, a lot of the other things, you know, I think that does bring some realism that you see in these two movies that you don't see in a lot of the much more digitally driven movies.
Yeah, I think like when they do a matte painting, that they do a slow move as a camera projection on, it adds something because the camera move is possible. It's something that someone could actually do in a helicopter or you know, from a tall building or whatever, that's not some impossible flying down a city canyon at 700 miles an hour with the camera and the characters flipping every which way that, you know, you might be tempted to do if you had a full CG city to fly your camera around in.
Yeah. Agreed. I agree totally. And you know, that's, I must admit, one of the criticisms I had, like, of the last Spider-Man film, it was just at some point just like a video game and I was just tuned out. Whereas I find myself on the edge of the seat in both of these films more than I did in, say, Spider-Man. But I'm going to have to excuse myself, gentlemen, because I have to get back to a zombie film.
I have to get back to preparing for my trip to Africa. So I have to get back to work.
So it's certainly been great having you on, David. It's absolutely terrific.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have joined you guys. I've been you know, listening to the show for a while and been doing this for a while, so I thought it was time to give back.
Yeah, no, it's really great to have you. So I'm sure we'll see you soon.
I'm filming next week, but hopefully I'll be able to join you guys possibly next week, or if not, soon after.
I'm going to be out of pocket, so I think Mike's going to pull together some other married men. Married or merry? Merry men.
Well, it depends whether or not Alberta's making cocktails. Definitely merry if she's involved.
You know, we've been very merry recently because Alberta's been in the office a lot, but now she's in New York, so we're very sober. And
I'm flying over to L.A. next week, actually. So I'll be in L.A. for the weekend of the end of this month. But I think we can still get an episode in before I go.
Excellent. And Mike, where can do you have a new term coming up with Epic
Actually, PhD? We're about halfway through the term. So we've got a new term coming up in October. But I'll talk more about that later because there's some actually really interesting production stuff that we're doing in the new term related to why I'm going to Los Angeles on the 31st.
Fantastic. And we've got a little production stuff going on, so we're going to be having some fun ourselves in the Pixel Corps. So that should be a lot of fun.
For those people that don't realize, I make wisecracks about Alberta's show, but I don't make wisecracks. I make aspirational comments. But it's actually a show that, while it appears to be an on-network show, is actually one of your shows, isn't it, Alex?
It is one of the shows that we put together. So it's Cocktails on the Fly, cocktailsonthefly.tv, and it has no effect on it at all. We just turn the cameras on and we let Alberta do the thing that she does.
And she does it
really well. And we really enjoy the special effects that we experience. I don't think we actually create them. We experience them when Alberta's on set. So it's
talk about shaky cam.
Yeah, exactly. we learned, do not let the cameraman sharing the drinks. It really does turn into a bit of a shaky cam. So, and David, do you have any kind of website or any
public? I am not on the internet tubes in any way right now. I own a whole bunch of domains and do nothing with them, but I do appear fairly regularly at the Improv and the Comedy Store here in LA. So I'll let people know when I'm there.
Sounds fantastic. Until later, keep it real.